You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
To guarantee full security of humanitarian convoys entering into Aleppo, there will be humanitarian windows established from 10 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon.
Russia announces a 3-hour humanitarian ceasefire for Aleppo, which the UN says isn't nearly enough, and which everyone, including Russia, ignores anyway. My guests Michael Binion and Samira Shackle will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including a build-up of troops and tensions along Russia's other front line between occupied Crimea and the rest of Ukraine, the wretched and perplexing reality of Australia's hardline policy on asylum seekers, as revealed by leaked documents from one of its offshore processing centres, and the political subtexts of prime ministerial holidays. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist at The Times, and Samira Shackle, freelance journalist for titles including The New Statesman, Al Jazeera, Deutsche Welle, and Monocle, among others. Welcome both. We will start in Aleppo, where all concerned seem not to have heard Russia's declaration of a 3-hour ceasefire earlier today. Fighting has continued as Syrian government forces have sought to reimpose the siege of what remains of the city that was broken last week by rebel forces, who in turn have been trying to consolidate their gains. Reports from Aleppo suggest that even the Russian Air Force was somehow unaware of the ceasefire, continuing to bomb on Assad's behalf. Samira, first of all, this came about because the UN wanted a weekly 48-hour ceasefire to allow aid deliveries. 3 hours appeared to have been Russia's compromise, such as it was. Should we assume that Russia wasn't really entirely serious about it?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely looks that way, doesn't it? I think the point raised by the UN was that in 3 hours you can't really do anything meaningful anyway. I mean, just the time to allow lorries to get in and out logistically, and just for sort of safe passage of that aid and the injured people who need to get out and so on. In 3 hours, it's not really possible. It's certainly not possible in 3 hours where no one respects the ceasefire anyway. But I think that the fact that it was such a small window, so far below what had been requested, the 48-hour window, that it's difficult to see it as anything other than lip service.
Michael, if we take as read then, and I think Samira's quite right, 3 hours is not enough time to drive a lorry into a place the size of Aleppo and back out, still less unload it in between time. If Russia wasn't serious about the ceasefire, what is Russia attempting to accomplish in Aleppo on Assad's behalf at this point?
Well, to capture it. I mean, Assad was extremely distraught. Well, he was furious at the fact that the rebels managed to break the siege and got back in and relieved their forces and probably brought in quite a lot of weapons. And they thought they'd got Aleppo more or less in their grip, which was going to be an important bargaining chip if and when any peace talks ever get going. The fact that Aleppo would be held by the Syrian government would put them in a much stronger position. And the fact that the rebels managed to retake it completely messed up those calculations. So I think the message has been, get it back at all costs.
Samira, there's another report today of a chlorine attack by government forces. This is not confirmed, although quite how you go about confirming anything that's going on in Aleppo is a wider question. The photos and the evidence look fairly damning, though. This is one of those slightly, I guess, futile in hindsight questions, but is the West's failure to act rather more decisively the first time Assad did this looking like a bigger mistake at this point?
I think so. Because, I mean, I think it's certainly, I think the argument against that intervention, that, you know, who's to say it would have been better now, etc., etc., I think, you know, you could argue, certainly, I think quite compellingly, you could argue that we wouldn't have necessarily a sort of calm and tranquil peace in Syria now. But I think the more atrocities we see perpetrated by the regime, you see that I think that was a pretty disastrous decision in many ways, because it kind of, by letting that red line disappear, the red line as it was called by Obama, it sort of sent a bit of a green light, I think, to Syria and the international backers of the Assad regime, that those whatever atrocity the regime wants to put place upon the people is not going to meet with any repercussions. And I think the fact is that it's naive to talk about intervention in Syria as if Western intervention is the only intervention that's happening. There is huge scale intervention in Syria.
Indeed,
it's
so.
Just it's not happening against what I would argue is the source of the problem, which is the Assad regime. It's happening on its behalf. And increasingly, the Western intervention that is happening, which is supposedly sort of targeted against Syria, against ISIS, sorry, is sort of increasingly tacitly working in cooperation with the powers seeking to keep that regime in power. So I think it was a pretty disastrous decision, yeah.
Michael, as you said, Assad and his Russian backers are clearly intent on capturing Aleppo, which is a hugely, or at least was a hugely economically important city and is still a strategically important city. From the rebels' point of view, this is the thing I'm struggling to understand myself. Is there any prospect of victory for them? And if so, what would it actually constitute?
Well, I don't think there is. I mean, I think the sooner all sides realise that no military victory by any side is possible, no comprehensive victory. A stalemate may be possible. Carving Syria up into zones of influence or regional control may also be possible. But if the rebels think that they can oust Assad and that he will fall from power, they've got another thing coming.
That moment does rather seem to have passed.
It has
it?
Indeed, and even the West doesn't seem to think that that's likely. And the West also thinks now that Assad, in one way or another, must be to some extent there when negotiations ever take place, if they ever take place. You've got to have whoever is nominally in control of the government as part of the bargaining. So I think the rebel objective is the same as Assad's, which is to seize and hold as much territory as possible, so that if any bargaining comes, then they feel they're in a more equal position. And Assad's aim is the exact opposite, to make sure that he has as much control of the country as possible, to say, well, I'm essentially in control anyway.
Samira, as hideous as this is getting, and it is getting hideous, there also does seem to be further instances of deliberate targeting of medical facilities in rebel-held parts of the city. And with all due acknowledgement that from the West's point of view, you certainly wouldn't start from here. Is there actually, as things are now, is there anything at all that the West can or should do in Syria that it isn't doing, or are we just stuck with having to watch this ghastly fiasco play out, however long that's going to take and however many lives that's going to take?
I think at this stage it is very, very difficult to see a clear course of further action that would be in any way decisive that the West could take, I think. Given how many different global powers are at play here now, I think, you know, it's been, yeah, it's not a new thought that for any sort of settlement to happen, Russia and Iran have to be brought on side. That remains as true now as it was a year ago, more true, if anything. So I think, it is difficult to see. I think certainly the time for greater action probably would have been a few years ago. And now, it's such a depressing situation. I agree with Michael. It's very difficult to see a decisive victory for either side in the conflict. And it's also difficult to see at this stage. I think having been pretty, you know, sort of ineffective in what intervention has been carried out by the West, having been pretty ineffective thus far, it's difficult to see how that can be salvaged now from the perspective of Western policymakers.
Okay, well, let's move seamlessly along to the other fight that Russia may or may not be having. Here is President Vladimir Putin sounding remarkably aggrieved for someone who has annexed a chunk of a neighbouring country.
This information is very disturbing. Our security services have prevented the penetration of a sabotage reconnaissance group from the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense in Crimea. I want to point out that the Russian side took losses. Two soldiers were killed, and we certainly won't excuse such actions. What we saw in Crimea was stupid and criminal. The underlying situation is even more alarming. Nothing will be gained from these attacks other than distracting the Ukrainian population from their ruined economy. We will do everything we can to ensure the safety of our infrastructure and of our citizens. And we will be taking extra security measures.
So that's Vladimir Putin alleging that Ukrainian forces have staged an incursion into Crimea. Although even if that is true, Ukraine could reasonably argue that Crimea is part of Ukraine and that they are therefore entitled to manoeuvre their forces about it. Nevertheless, Putin says Russia intends to further buttress Crimea's land and sea forces. Michael, I'm not sure about you. I particularly enjoyed the bit where Vladimir Putin accused somebody else of trying to start some sort of fight in order to distract the local people from their collapsing economy. Are we buying the idea that Ukrainian saboteurs are operating in Crimea?
We might not be, but the Russians certainly are. I think that message has great resonance within Russia, and it was addressed to Russians, not to the West. The Russians do believe that the Ukrainians have been unreasonable. Their propaganda in Moscow, of course, has been saying this all along. And there are a large number of Ukrainian refugees in southern Russia. I've just been in southern Russia for 3 weeks, and there are plenty of students who can't study in Ukraine who are studying in southern Russia. And the Russians simply don't understand the Western view or the Ukrainian view that they have, in that the Russians have violated Ukrainian territory in Crimea. But that said, it's surprising that Putin would make a big incident of this unless you reckon the key factor, he has difficult parliamentary elections coming up in September. And what better way to deflect attention than point again to outside forces trying to threaten Russia? It's the old trick, and he's pulling it for everything it's worth.
Samira, this has always been the assumption that a lot of people were making about the intervention in Ukraine, the same as Russia's intervention in Georgia, that it was what's called a frozen conflict, which Russia can then choose to heat up at any time that it decides it's actually politically expedient. Do you get the impression that that's what's going on here, or are there genuine concerns that Russia might be going somewhere with this, i.e. further into Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty inscrutable, the Kremlin, I think, from the outside. You know, I think clearly there's something here. I think there's a few options that, you know, it's a sort of creating a bit of sound and fury to distract from other issues. It's could be sort of planning some sort of small scale intervention. I think there's been talk about the possibility that Putin wants to create some sort of security corridor, because while it's been fairly peaceful on the ground, my understanding is around Crimea, and so this is a bit of a fabrication that actually, you know, that there have been a few problems given from the fact that what was a peninsula when in the time of the USSR is now effectively an island at the end of Ukraine. It's separated from the Russian mainland by a lot of water. So there's been talk about maybe he wants to go in to create some sort of security corridor to guarantee things like power. There have been blackouts there, I think, when Ukrainian activist groups have attacked power supplies and so on. Or there's the possibility of much larger scale military intervention, which is a big worry, you know, sort of the idea of something what was spoken about back in 2014 when Crimea was annexed, the idea of Russia sort of intervening to create some sort of land link between the Russian separatist parts of Ukraine all the way across the country and Donetsk and Luhansk or to Crimea. And, you know, I think it's a concern. It's difficult to predict because, well, you know, from the sort of macho rhetoric and rabble-rousing that we're seeing could mean any number of things.
I mean, there has also been the thought floated that perhaps, you know, Russia could sort of manoeuvre westward past Odessa to the pro-Russian separatists in Transnistria and Moldova. That strikes me as somewhat fanciful, but there again, Putin is yet another one of those things I've been entirely wrong about sequentially for about 2 years now. Michael, is there, from Russia's point of view, and as you said, you've just been there, if you were sitting in the Kremlin at this point, is there any imaginable point to actually intervening in Ukraine any more than you already have? Because Russia has that frozen conflict now. It has that situation it can amplify any time it deems it useful. Why bother taking any more of Ukraine?
I don't think there is any actual point in now opening new military operations. What there is a lot of point is in saying that things are heating up and that Ukrainians are not serious about peace talks and therefore Russia can't go to peace talks and that they are a threat and the West is also a threat. That is all a scenario that he can get up. He doesn't necessarily then have to follow through with any further intervention, but he can do a lot of saber rattling and that has a lot of use. He is scheduled to have peace talks with the Ukrainians and with the French and Germans another round of these peace talks fairly soon. Now, if he's serious about anything, he will have to make some concessions. That's not a good thing to do at a time when you've got difficult elections coming up at home and where concerns about corruption are still pretty large. Of course he's going to win the elections. I mean, there's no question about it.
Do you think?
Oh, well, no question. But he does need to distract attention from continuous grumbling still about the state of Russia and corruption and the fact the economy is not doing very well. Nobody's turning against Putin, but they are beginning to grumble about things. So you need to whip up a new sense of trouble overseas and threat and all that, which he's very good at doing. You don't necessarily need to follow through, though.
I mean, on which subject, Samira, is it also possible, do you think, to look at this as Russia's response to NATO's build-up in the Baltics and Poland, which, of course, NATO would argue was its response to Russia intervening in Ukraine in the first place?
Yeah, certainly. I think that, that's definitely... definitely one view of it, and I don't think you can ever, even if it is a slightly bonkers regime or, you know, a lot of posturing, I don't think you can ever totally discount the push and pull and reaction and counter-reaction that is always a part of international relations, particularly between Russia and mainland Europe and sort of NATO bloc.
And just final thought on this, Michael, what is the smart response to this from not just Ukraine? Petro Poroshenko, the president thereof, has requested a phone call with Vladimir Putin, but from the West in general. Is it to react to this or just let Russia kind of blow off some steam and hope they calm down eventually?
I think it's to say we are watching pretty closely and say we would take any further provocation extremely seriously and any thought of sanctions being eased would be blown away straight away. It's also to say we are fully aware and watching what's happening, but I think it's not to make counter threats. It is to let them blow off steam because if, as I suspect, this is something done for internal political manoeuvring and posturing, then it doesn't really matter. And he's trying to provoke a reaction from the West, which we don't need to give. But it's also to make clear that sanctions remain until there are serious peace talks, and he's got to start thinking about those.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Samira Shackle and Michael Binion. Coming up next, the leak of the Nauru files suggests that the Australian approach to asylum seekers and illegal immigrants may be even odder than suspected.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in, and it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cosy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Michael Binion. Now, for a country founded by people on boats who nobody invited, Australia is remarkably touchy about people on boats who nobody invited. This week's leak of documents from Australia's offshore detention camp for asylum seekers on the isolated guano heap of Nauru do not make for edifying reading. As is usually the case when one group of people is allowed total and unaccountable power over another, abuses of various sorts, many involving children, appear to be chronic. Samira, it is gruesome reading, the more so if you are, as I am, Australian. The country's immigration minister, Peter Dutton, has responded by saying some of the reports are invented or exaggerated, which is frankly not impossible when you have desperate people attempting to make a case. They can't all be, though, can they?
No, they can't all be. And I think that as you say, it's pretty depressing reading. I think the overwhelming picture, if you look at these files, is not just of you know, sort of countless examples of horrible abuse, but also of systemic failings in procedures, failings in understanding. There's all sorts of reports about, you know, and of course, it's not just abuses by guards, it's also abuses by other detainees, but abuses by guards of sort of accounts being questioned and so on, and that there clearly aren't, if something is so widespread, even making allowances for false allegations, which I would, you know, given given the scale of the problem, I would sort of question the response of the Australian government on that. But there is clearly a systemic failing happening here. Something is going wrong. And I think the fact that the response from the Australian immigration minister was to say, well, they're lying so they can get to the mainland, I think that basically proves the point that there's a systemic failing, that there's a failure to take it seriously and a failure to sort of look at it. And I think one of the other things that really astounded me was just the gall that I think it was the same. The immigration minister said that that actually what we should take from this is that there are very rigorous reporting procedures, which is definitely looking for the silver lining on that cloud.
Looking very hard for the silver lining in a very dark cloud. Again, Michael, even if, and there is no way of knowing, but even if, let's try taking the immigration minister's word for it, even if, say, at a wildly fantastical estimation, half the stories were invented or exaggerated, and only half of what's been reported is true, it would still be pretty gruesome.
It would, indeed. And I think it is inevitable if you try to outsource an issue as sensitive and as concerning.
Well, this is one of the issues, that the offshore processing centres are privately run.
They're privately run.
There's almost no access from journalists or neutral
observers.
That's the problem.
And it's inevitable, even if it was not concerning immigration, but concerning some other social problem. And you, say, ordinary prisoners or something, you sent them all to some offshore territory and you gave a private firm control who would try to make a quick buck as much as possible by cutting down on, say, food or proper supervision or whatever it might be, which is probably what also may be happening, it's going to result in tragedy. And we see that the control of people in detained situations, as we saw in Baghdad, in Abu Ghraib, they were prisoners, but these people are being held in similar conditions, almost inevitably goes wrong unless you have very close, tight, rigorous supervision and control by the authorising government.
Samira, aside, this is not saying that was going to sound bad. I was going to say aside from the treatment of the detainees, and I don't wish to downplay it at all because it is horrible, but were they being better treated? Were the conditions more humane, the accommodation, the food better, etc.? Would the policy then be defensible? Because what Australia always points to is that in terms of dissuading people from making the trip and therefore stopping people from drowning, it has worked. There have been no reported deaths at sea since 2013. There were more than 900 in the 5 years before that.
I think it's a very tricky argument to make because it's been, even before these files were leaked, the policy of shipping asylum seekers out to these islands has been repeatedly criticised very harshly by the UN. It's the fact that even if people are granted refugee status, they're then on Nauru, and what are they going to do? There aren't jobs there. There aren't sort of opportunities, I think.
Well, that's been the thing underpinning Australia's policy, just saying you won't end up in Australia.
Yeah, I know. But actually, if you think about the cost, it costs $1.2 billion to the Australian taxpayer a year. We're not talking about a lot of people. There's 500 or so on Nauru. There's about 850 or so on the other offshore detention facility. Manus, why if a proportion of those people are then granted refugee status, it is of net value to the Australian taxpayer if the people with refugee status are able to work and contribute taxes, rather than spending over $1 billion every year on keeping them in hideously inhumane conditions, and then even once they get out, they're effectively in a prison. And actually, you know, the criticisms of the policy far predate the leak of these files. Those reports already of sort of people being suicidal and desperate, and I think still feeling like they're in a prison after they get out of the actual prison.
The argument against that being, of course, Michael, that if it did then become possible for people arriving in Australia by boat to end up becoming functional tax-paying members of Australian society, then the boats start coming again and people start drowning again.
Well, that is an argument. Of course, it would be much more effective if they simply shot all the people. I mean, that would stop them coming. But, you know, to take a brutal line like that, I mean, it just depends. The end never justifies such means. You cannot say, we're going to stop people coming and make it brutal so they don't come. If you shot them, of course, they won't come. But I mean, that is cynicism carried to the furthest degree. You have to work out what is a humane response of a civilized country. You have to try to deter people from coming. You have to make it perhaps possible for more people to come by legal means. I mean, the Australians boast endlessly about this point system they have, and everyone seems to think that point system is the best thing Australians have. Point system on immigration is to Australia what, like, cheese is to France and cuckoo clocks to Switzerland. You know, it's what everybody knows and says it's wonderful. But actually, on closer scrutiny.
We haven't actually started putting it on T-shirts and fridge magnets.
It doesn't actually work very well. You don't really get the people you need because the points are based on a rather spurious set of criteria. It's probably better just to let people come if they have qualifications without all these extra things added in. But the fact is that if you have a functioning immigration system that is open to most people being able to apply to it, then that would be the humane response to stopping people coming illegally.
Okay, well, finally tonight, it is that time at which British people react to the 1 month of decent weather they're going to get all year by going somewhere else. It's often the case, however, that prime ministers feel constrained from joining that exodus as political expediency condemns them to be photographed pretending to have fun in Cornwall. But Britain's new prime minister, Theresa May, appears unburdened by any such concerns. She is going hiking in Switzerland. Michael, I'm rather impressed by this, I have to say. I can well imagine that some Ernest Spad has told her that now she's Prime Minister, she can't take holidays in her favourite Swiss mountains, as she often has before, that she has to go somewhere in Britain, and she appears to have said, don't be ridiculous, nobody cares.
Quite right. And if she has said that, good for her. absolutely. I mean, we are learning more and more that Theresa May is her own woman. She's very keen not to be another Thatcher, but she has characteristics that are quite Thatcherite. She won't be told what to do. She won't be bossed about. Mm. She knows what she wants. She's very decisive. And like Thatcher, she likes going to the Alps. I mean, Thatcher also used to take holidays in either Switzerland or Austria.
Rather helpfully, the producer has very kindly put a photo of both women doing exactly that in the script.
Well, quite right. And that's what Thatcher used to do. Queen Victoria loved Switzerland. She used to go there even in her old age. She went off to some elegant hotel with a nice view, and the whole of the court would have to traipse out with her.
I mean, Samir, why do we get so upset about prime ministers? Actually, it's not we. It strikes me as a peculiarly British thing. This strange resentment the British have of the person in charge of the country enjoying their life in any sense whatsoever. Even when there's some sort of crisis and there's always outrage that the prime minister's on holiday, they've got a telephone.
Yeah, I know. I do find it very odd. It is very odd. It's a weird preoccupation that we appear to have as a nation. I'm not really sure what it is. I don't know if it's the sort of eternal underdog spirit of not wanting to see people have a nice time. I don't know, really. But
It depends how nice. Yeah. I mean, Tony Blair used to borrow palaces from millionaires in Italy.
Yeah, that didn't play terrifically well.
It certainly didn't.
And he Cliff would, Richard and
he'd go to the Caribbean and he would sort of elbow his influential colleagues into getting their holiday retreats lent to him, as it were. And that did play rather badly.
Yeah, that's true. And I suppose I could understand perhaps during the financial crisis or something. I think one of the things was sort of putting money into the British economy and having holidays at home. I can sort of see then, but generally, I don't know.
Michael, it is sure as shooting that somewhere in this city there is some poor hack right now trying to crank out 800 words on what her choice of Switzerland means, that, you know, that it's a non-EU country, et cetera. Should that journalist be taking a long, hard look at themselves and their life choices, or does her choice of the Swiss mountains tell us something about the Prime Minister?
Well, I think the journalist should also take a hike, literally. I mean, try it. It's pretty invigorating. It's pretty health-giving and be good for you, and it will make our Prime Minister come back in fine health and full of good spirits.
I mean, Samira, are there any destinations that would just be completely outrageous? Like if they went on holiday to, I don't know, North Korea or somewhere, would that be...
probably wouldn't play that well, would it? Just on a holiday.
Strike me as an adventurous
Egypt would
choice.
Be dicey. I mean, Egypt is a classic holiday destination, and you could argue it's very agreeable, but the Egyptian government is one that you don't really want to be seeing...
Tony Blair go on holiday at Hosni Mubarak's expense?
Well, yes, but I mean, at the moment, it's probably quite a bit worse.
That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Enjoy your holidays wherever it is you're going. Michael Binion and Samira Shackle, thank you for joining us. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jimena Mignan. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. There's music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. There's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.